everyone, and welcome to the White House. Apologize for running a few minutes late today. It's another busy day here at the White House, but we're finally starting, and we're very pleased to have David Axelrod join us to answer some questions that we've gotten over the last few days and that we will be taking through the website. To introduce myself, I'm Macon Phillips. I work on the new media team. We work on whitehouse.gov. If you want to ask some questions during this, you can head over there to whitehouse.gov/live and join the Facebook chat that's happening right now. But we've already been collecting some questions, so we'll just start right into it.
Great.
The first question comes from Di Kaczynski, who says, I lost my job on June 4th, 2009, after 19 years with the same company, and have been able to find anyone to hire me. Current unemployment benefits run out in another month or so. Does the president have any plans to try to get these benefits extended again, or am I just out of luck?
No, you're not out of luck. The president's going to continue to fight to get these benefits extended. When we have an extraordinary situation as we've faced over the last couple of years, it is important that we rally as a country and make sure that folks who have worked hard and met their responsibilities and got caught up in this economic downturn can survive that storm and find other work and move on. And so that's why we've fought several times to extend the unemployment insurance, and we hope to do that. Hope to do that again. And thank you for your question. Let me just say how pleased I am, Macon, to be here and do this. You know, when the president ran for office, one of the things that we felt we wanted to do was give people a greater opportunity to participate in their own government. Ultimately, we're here to work for the American people, and it's important to have a dialogue with the American people. So this is a great opportunity, and I appreciate it. And I appreciate all of you who have sent in questions and who are monitoring this today. I hope it's the first of many conversations we can have.
Great. Well, we'll move on to an issue that a lot of people are talking about, the president in his position on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Mm-hmm. I had a question that's pretty representative of that. Comes from Walter Birchill, who says, here's a question from a U.S. Marine that was discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Why is the president appealing the recent court decision? Does he have faith that Congress will repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell this year? Weren't the three branches of government set up to ensure checks and balances?
Well, first of all, Walter, if you're the Marine, thank you for your service and for your question. One of the things the president made clear when he campaigned and when he arrived here, both to the American people and to the Department of Defense and our military leaders, was that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was a policy that just didn't make sense. We were depriving our country of the talents of many and commitment of many, many Americans who wanted to serve, and it made no sense to exclude them. It was unfair, unjust, and unwise for our national security. And so he said that we were going to end this policy, and he put us on a track to do that. The Pentagon has been engaged in a study on how to effectuate this with a minimum of disruption, and their report is due back very shortly. There is a law in place that was passed by the Congress, and we are a nation of laws, and so we want to work through the Congress to change that law. We came very close before the break. It was stopped by a filibuster by the Republicans in the Senate, but we're gonna keep working to change it there and work internally to change that policy. And in terms of the appeal, it is the custom of the U.S. government to appeal laws of Congress that were challenged in lower courts, and we did that. But it should be in no means read as an abandonment of a commitment that we intend to keep and we will keep.
Okay, great. The next question comes from Beth Barrows, who asks, David, does President Obama have any plans to address the reform of the way credit reporting agencies, TransUnion, Experian, et cetera, work? Will the new Consumer Protection Agency help consumers who have had their credit unjustly trashed by these CRAs?
Well, let's separate out issues. The CRAs are largely responsible for rating bonds, and there, too, there was a tremendous problem. There were conflicts of interest that called into question the legitimacy of much of what they were doing, and it was one of the reasons why we had the financial crisis. Some exotic financial instruments were being rated much more highly than they deserved, and people were making investments on that basis, and ultimately the whole house of cards collapsed. In terms of your question and your situation, one of the reasons the president fought so hard to have a Consumer Finance Protection Bureau created was to have one place in the government where the sole responsibility is to look after consumers. And part of their authority will be to ensure that if you get denied credit or there are other apparent irregularities, that you can request your credit report for free. And you can see exactly what was said about you, because many times people didn't even know why they were being denied credit. And secondly, you'll be able to appeal to the new Consumer Finance Protection Bureau to redress erroneous reports and deal with your situation. Now, I will tell you that, you know, we fought hard to pass that financial reform in which the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau was created. There are those who suggest that they want to repeal it now. There's a tremendous pressure from some elements of Wall Street to do so, and we're going to resist that because consumers need to be protected against just the kind of situation that you're raising here.
Okay, great. While you were answering that, we had another question come in from Pam Hoffman on education.
Yes.
She asks, what is President Obama doing about the high price of education? I used to perceive financial aid as helping people better themselves, but it's really gambling. We gamble that the economy will support us paying back the loans. If we are wrong, it's a financial disaster, not dischargeable via bankruptcy. And as such, financial aid entities are making high-risk loans. These entities face no regulations or risk. So back to the original question, what is President Obama doing about the high price of education?
Well, first of all, it's a critical question because it's the cost of education, of a higher education, has put so much of a burden on families and on young people leaving our colleges, just at a time when we know that higher education is absolutely the key to success in the 21st century. The high-wage jobs of the future are going to require higher education, and we want to make sure that more and not fewer people can go and they don't end up deep in the hole when they come out of it. That's why we work so hard to change the federal student loan system. In the past, we've had middlemen, banks and other middlemen, administering these loans, and had we kept the system that was in place, in the next 10 years, we'd be spending $60 billion just on subsidies to these middlemen. We changed that system. It took a big fight, but we changed that system so that $60 billion is now going to be devoted to grants to students who need help going to college, as well as to lift our community college system, which is the gateway for so many young people in terms of getting higher education, and also for older folks who need retraining to gain the skills they need for new jobs. We also had, as part of the Recovery Act, a tax credit for college tuition. We want to make that permanent, and we're going to fight for that in the future. And obviously, we're also going to encourage economies at these institutions so as to hold down the inflation and college costs, which have been great. But this is a significant problem, not just for young people across this country and families, but for our country itself. If we're going to be competitive, we need to make college education affordable for all students who are willing to work for it, who are qualified for it.
Great. So to change subjects a little bit, this is another common theme we're seeing, maybe best summed up by Paulina. We'll just say Paulina, who asked, David Axelrod, could you please talk about what worked and what didn't work and why between the White House and the Senate in the attempt to put together a climate energy bill? What actually happened at some of the key moments? What are the lessons learned and what's the plan?
Well, look, there is no doubt that the issue of energy and climate change is a significant challenge for our country, and it is an obligation we have to future generations. First, as an economic issue, the clean energy technology and clean energy manufacturing is one of the growth industries of the future. We see the Chinese, for example, making a huge investment in the new clean energy technologies. And so as an economic matter, it makes sense for us to invest in those. As part of the Recovery Act, we did make significant investments in seed money to lure private investors into this arena, and we got a 3-to-1 match from private investors for this. And as a result, we'll double the use of renewable energy in this country over a very short period of time. We also raised fuel efficiency standards for the first time in 30 years, and we did it in conjunction with industry, first on cars and then on trucks and then on larger trucks, and that's going to make a big difference. But we want to work through Congress to get additional legislation passed. We had a climate change and energy bill in the House that passed, and it, as you point out, it stalled in the Senate. Like so many other things, there was a filibuster on the part of Republicans in the Senate that stopped us from moving forward. We want to find common ground on these issues, however. I think everyone recognizes that we have to move forward on the energy front, that the fuels and the technologies of the 20th century aren't going to make it in the 21st century, and that for not just our economy and our air and the quality of our air and water, but the survival of the planet, we need to move forward, and the president is committed to doing that. But the short answer to your question is, there simply weren't the votes to break a filibuster and move forward on an energy bill.
Okay. Okay, our next question comes from Dorothy Carlo, who asks, it is clear to me that campaign reform would solve a lot of the problems people complain about. Citizens United has made campaign reform all the more urgent. What is the White House doing to reverse Citizens United and furthering the goal of campaign reform?
And let's be clear what Dorothy's referring to. There was a decision early this year by the United States Supreme Court that reversed generations of precedent and said that corporations had First Amendment rights and could advertise in political campaigns, participate in political campaigns, advertise in political campaigns, advocate for the election or defeat of candidates. And that, coupled with a loophole in the law that allows certain organizations to take unlimited contributions and run political advertising without disclosing where that money is coming from, has opened up the floodgate, and we've seen hundreds of millions of dollars of campaign commercials running almost entirely against Democratic candidates. It's a 7-to-1 kind of a situation. But be that as it may, it is a thing that makes a mockery of our campaign finance system. Most people, if I make a contribution, if Macon makes a contribution, we're limited to $2,400, and we have to disclose that we've made that contribution. But what we see now are people from the oil industry and Wall Street and other interests that have tremendous interest in what's going on in Congress because of their own pecuniary issues, making $1 million and more contributions. This is all based on investigative reporting because they don't have to disclose it to these organizations that run negative ads under benign-sounding names like the Crossroads GPS organization and the American Action Network and Americans for Prosperity. But these are essentially front groups for interests who want to influence our government and hijack the national agenda. It's a really, really serious problem. If a lobbyist can go into a congressman and say, if you don't vote our way on this issue, we're going to run millions of dollars of campaign ads against you, and no one will even know it's coming from us, it's going to have a profound influence. So our answer to that was to put a bill to support a law in Congress that would have just forced them to disclose their contributions and to identify in the advertising who the chief contributor was behind these ads. We passed out of the House. We got 59 votes in the United States Senate to break a filibuster, every Democrat, and 41 Republicans blocked it. and essentially voted to keep the American people in the dark. That law would have forced groups that supported Republicans or Democrats to simply disclose where their money was coming from. And we're going to continue to fight for that even after this election. If anything, this election should underscore how insidious it is to allow the system that is now in place to continue. And so we're going to fight making to force disclosure in the future.
So while you were answering that, Ron Hinton, who's in the chat, said, so business is evil. Is that what you're trying to say?
No, business is not evil, but we shouldn't have a two-tiered approach to government and politics, where some people operate in the daylight and make their arguments through in transparent ways, and others use essentially these loopholes to leverage tremendous influence. And skew the national agenda. Business is the heartbeat of our economy. We want people who make things, create things, sell things to succeed. We want entrepreneurs to have an environment in which they can innovate. We've invested a lot of money in encouraging innovation. The president has proposed tax breaks, a permanent tax break for research and development. The president has proposed expensing changes so that in 2011, while we're digging our way out from this economic mess we walked into, that companies can buy equipment and not pay taxes on those purchases. So no, business is to be encouraged. What is to be discouraged is people trying to game the system, operating in the shadows, putting their thumb on the scale, trying to buy a Congress in order to get their agenda through. Because what happens is we get unwarranted tax loopholes that favor specific industries or even specific businesses. We get regulatory policies that conspire against the American people. An example is on this financial situation. We didn't have the appropriate oversight in place during the 8 years before we got here, and it led to a financial crisis, the proportions of which we haven't seen since the Great Depression. So, we want everybody to play on a level playing field, and we want people to be transparent about what they're arguing for and why. And if we do that, we're going to be a better and stronger country, and business is going to do better as well, because you won't have one business, again, putting their thumb on the scale, using their political connections and their political money, and disadvantaging other businesses who don't have that ability.
Okay. Great. Well, let's change gears, and before I ask the next question, though, let me just remind everyone, if the sound's not working or you're seeing that something's wrong with your screen, just hit refresh. Sometimes we have some issues on that. Again, if you want to join the conversation, you can head to whitehouse.gov/live, where there's a very active chat going on right now. I'm trying to pull some questions from this. But let's dive into the next one that has more to do with healthcare. And this one comes from Arlene Tomasetti, who says, I am 53, widowed, and a waitress and a freelance web designer. Neither of my jobs provide health insurance. I make very little money, and I'm wondering how this health plan can help me find insurance. I will be able to afford, and when can I expect to be able to be insured? I have issues, but won't see a doctor since I'm sure they will require treatment, of which I absolutely cannot afford right now. Any hope for someone like me?
Well, there is hope, Arlene, and that's why the president made the fight that he fought for health insurance reform. It is specifically people like you who are most disadvantaged in this health care system, because health care for people in the individual market who don't get it through their employers has been exponentially more expensive than the policies that people can get through their jobs. And it's priced people like you out of the insurance market, so you can't get the health care you need. The whole idea of health insurance reform is to make sure that people like you can get health insurance at a price you can afford. And the first thing that you can do is go to the new website that's been established as a result of that law called healthcare.gov. And on that website, you can type in your information and find out exactly what insurance policies are available in your market to people like you, public and private. You can see their costs, you can see their benefits, and you may find that there are policies that you can afford that will be helpful. But when this plan is fully implemented in 2014, you're also going to be able to buy a healthcare policy through what's called health insurance exchange, essentially co-ops or markets where private insurance companies will compete for your business, and you'll be able to buy them. And if you need some help in terms of subsidies to afford them, you will be able to get that as well. I'd say the other thing, I don't know when you say you have issues, whether that refers to a pre-existing medical condition, which sometimes has led to people being banned from getting insurance. Part of this law is to end that practice and to say to insurance companies, you have to give everyone a chance to get coverage, even people with pre-existing conditions. Right now, under the law, as of September, children with pre-existing conditions must be covered. So families who have a child, I was in that position, with a pre-existing medical condition and are denied care for their child, that no longer happens. But in 2014, everyone with pre-existing medical conditions will be able to get health insurance at a price they can afford. And there are some policies available now for people with pre-existing conditions that may be affordable to you. So I'd check into that healthcare.gov website. And yes, there is hope on the way here.
Great. So we're going to take two more questions.
Okay.
The next one comes from Josh Smith, who says, this week, Bloomberg ran a news piece about large U.S. corporations like Google sheltering profits overseas. According to the article, Google's average tax rate is around 2.5%. My personal average income tax rate last year was more than 10 times that. Given our severe budget difficulties, why are we not immediately closing the loopholes that let America's largest companies avoid paying their fair share of taxes?
Well, Josh, that's a really good question, and it's one we've been asking. Our budget proposals have contained hundreds of billions of dollars of these corporate loopholes that we want to close because they don't lead to jobs and growth here in this country, and including tax breaks that encourage corporations to actually move jobs overseas. This is a fight we're going to continue to wage. We, at a time when we need not just to close our budget gap and deal with our deficits, but also encourage growth here, we ought to evaluate these tax breaks and ask the question, are these really strengthening our country, or are these some of those that are inserted by lobbyists and special interests into the tax code for their own benefit? And we're going to continue to make that fight. As you can imagine, there's lively debate on this in Congress. One of the reasons why special interests are pouring so much money into these secret funds, these front groups to influence this election, is because they want to protect those advantages. And I'm not talking about any particular company here, but we need to look at our tax code and make some judgments here as to whether the things that are in it are sensible, and whether they actually promote a good business climate and growth and jobs or not.
Great. Well, our last question comes from Sheila Parker Stone, who asks, I think, a bigger picture question moving forward. Mr. Axelrod, please try to explain this question for me. It's obvious that the Republican Party is not interested in bipartisanship. I fully understand the president's desire to work this way, as he is president of us all. Please explain how the president is going to move forward on this climate of civil war between the parties. We, the citizens of this country, really need a more convincing answer from the president. He needs to take a stand more vocally and convince us that he is above this political climate and only interested in defending us.
Well, look, I think that if anybody who watched the president campaign, and anybody who's really spent time watching him govern, understand that he agrees with that. I mean, even today as he campaigns, he makes a point that I think we all share, which is that we may be Democrats or Republicans, but we're Americans first. And we're here not to promote the interests of a political party, but to promote the interests of the American people. And we would like nothing better than to have partners, Republicans and Democrats, in moving this country forward. We came to office with that expectation. We came to office at a time of great economic crisis, and we're hoping to forge bipartisan coalitions to deal with those problems. We weren't successful in persuading the folks on the other side of the aisle to do that. They made a judgment. I believe it was a political judgment, but I'll let others make their own assessment of that. But we weren't able to get a lot of cooperation. I think it's very clear that we have an election next week in which whatever the ultimate outcome is, there'll be more parity between the parties here in Washington. I'm hoping that will imbue folks on the other side with a greater sense of responsibility and an interest in cooperating, and they will meet with a welcoming hand from us. There are no doubt things that we will never agree on, but there are also things that we can agree on, and we ought to put, we have elections, they're hotly contested. We ought to be willing to put those aside after the election, and wait. And take up the next election closer to the day when people vote and not contest it from the moment one election ends. And that would be our hope. We've got big problems and big challenges in this country and big opportunities, but we're not going to be able to seize them if we're engaged in partisan warfare day after day after day.
Great. Well, Robin Randall has one comment that says, keep up the great work. You look thin. Are you eating your vegetables?
I have lost a bunch of weight. I've told this story before. It was, I had a parasite. I don't know where I acquired it. I don't think it's a commentary on Washington, D.C., so let me make that clear. But then I just decided to go with it. But I will say that Macon's my workout buddy here, so I'm hoping to have a salutary effect on him here.
I appreciate it. All right. Well, thanks a lot. And okay. Thanks, everybody else, for joining. If you came late, we'll be posting the whole video to whitehouse.gov so you can go back and find questions you may have missed. And look forward to doing more of these with you every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. We actually have another one coming up on Thursday with White House photographer Pete Souza, who's going to be taking your questions about your favorite photos. That should be pretty fun.
Yes.
So thanks, everyone, for joining. Have a great day.